Each year, a number of impactful patent cases are presented to the Supreme Court. In some instances, these cases can have significant implications. 2011 is no exception. In the first half of this year, three cases will be heard by the Supreme Court that could greatly influence the future of IP law. Eye for Eye versus Microsoft, Global Tech Appliances versus SEB, and Stanford University versus Roche Molecular Systems. Finnegan partner Erica Arner and associate Justin Lowry join us now to discuss these cases, their potential impact on IP, and in a larger sense, the recent increase in patent cases making their way to the Supreme Court and additional patent cases to watch for this year. First of all, Erica and Justin, thank you for joining us. One of the cases I just mentioned, Eye for Eye versus Microsoft, Finnegan is a part of the Eye for Eye team. Erica, let me start with you. Can you provide some background on the Eye for Eye versus Microsoft case and the potential implications for future patent cases?
I think of all of the patent cases before the Supreme Court this term so far, the Eye for Eye case has the biggest potential to be the real blockbuster. And that's because it involves all patents. It's not specific to a technology area or to a source of funding or anything that would narrow the impact of the decision, but rather it applies to every patent. Essentially, the technology involved in the case has to do with word processing software, and in particular, an editor that's part of Microsoft Word, and the editor enables users to edit and create XML documents, which are a certain type of coded documents. And Eye for Eye had a patent on the XML editing feature and got a jury verdict of $200 million against Microsoft for the infringing Microsoft Word product. The verdict was enhanced by the judge. They added $90 million additional in damages for a total damages award of $290 million, which was one of the largest patent infringement verdicts ever affirmed on appeal. After the case was taken to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, the court affirmed the finding of infringement, affirmed the damages award, and the case has now been appealed by Microsoft to the Supreme Court. The legal issue in the case is really the standard for challenging an issued patent. So a patent that's already issued out of the patent office usually is presumed valid, and that comes from the Patent Act. And therefore, a challenger to a patent bears the burden of showing somehow that the patent is invalid. And that has traditionally been a pretty high burden, that the challenger has to show invalidity by clear and convincing evidence. That's most often showing invalidity based on prior art. So if there is a reference or a patent or something that predates the challenged patent and therefore shows that the challenged patent is not new, then to show that case, the challenger would have to meet that high burden of proof, clear and convincing evidence. But now Microsoft is asking the Supreme Court to lower that standard, to make it easier to invalidate patents with a lower evidentiary standard for those challenges. And really, the impact of the case could be quite far-reaching. It could make it easier to challenge all issued patents. But I think one of the other impacts of a decision lowering that burden would also make things much more difficult for the Patent Office. Examiners at the Patent Office are already overwhelmed. Their backlog is into the years of examining patent applications. And if it becomes easier to challenge a patent based on prior art, then I think applicants will be inclined to file even more art for the Patent Office to consider during the initial examination process, and it will exacerbate the existing backload at the Patent Office. So it should be interesting to see what the court does. Of course, they rarely take a case simply to affirm it, so we will have to watch and see what they're going to do with it, but it's certainly a case that's caught a lot of attention so far, even though the argument has not even happened yet.
Let's turn now to the Global Tech Appliances versus SEB case. Justin, can you give us an overview of this case, and why is this decision worth following? What will it mean for IP?
This case involves a company that has been found liable for induced infringement. That is, the petitioner here was not directly selling or offering to sell patented technology in the United States, but were sued for causing another company to do so. the company here sold infringing deep fryers overseas in Hong Kong to companies that then sold them in the United States. The defendants claimed at trial and at the federal circuit that they didn't have the proper state of mind to be liable for actively inducing infringement. In contrast to direct infringement, in induced infringement, there is at least some requirement for the defendant to have some type of particular wrongful state of mind to be liable. The defendants here argued that they didn't know about the patent currently in suit and that they had an opinion from counsel telling them that this technology wasn't infringing on any existing patents, though the opinion counsel never discovered the patent in suit during his search of existing patents. The Federal Circuit responded that they had showed deliberate indifference to the existence of a potential patent, in particular because they didn't tell their opinion counsel, who was out searching to see if there were any patents they could be infringing on, that they had reverse-engineered this technology from a competitor, the plaintiff in this case. Under the Federal Circuit's decision, all that is necessary is deliberate indifference to the existence of a patent, not necessarily knowledge of a patent, in order to be liable for induced infringement. Defendants are now arguing to the Supreme Court that that standard should be higher, some sort of purposeful, culpable, affirmative action to provide the necessary state of mind for induced infringement. The petitioners are mostly relying on recent copyright decisions on induced infringement in that area. Looking at the broader picture, were the standard to change, it would have an obvious impact on any litigation that is or will be using the Federal Circuit's deliberate indifference standard, but also could change how companies deal with opinion counsel or go about patent investigations.
The third case on our docket is Stanford University versus Roche Molecular Systems. It's been described in the media as a high-stakes patent dispute. Erica, what makes this case so significant?
Well, there are a couple things that make the Stanford case pretty significant. One is the technology involved. It involves a test for measuring the effectiveness of antiviral drugs to battle HIV. And so it's an important technology socially, and there is a big community around supporting developments for these kinds of drugs, these kinds of testing methods. And so it's an important case because it involves a fairly important technology area. The other thing that makes this case a high-stakes case is because it involves government-funded research at universities, which is really one of the primary ways that many of the huge innovations in the past decades have come to be. So essentially, this case involves the interpretation of an act called the Bayh-Dole Act, which actually just marked its 30th anniversary. Before that act, anytime the government gave a university or a company or an individual money to do research, any inventions that came out of that research were owned by the government. And it was really an unfortunate system because the government would have the rights, they would own the inventions, whether it was a new way to test for diseases or a new software innovation, the government would own them. And what happened practically is that the inventions languished in the files of a bureaucrat in some branch of the government. They were never developed, or very rarely developed and commercialized to the benefit of the public. And it was really an unfortunate system and caused a lot of economic disadvantage for the U.S. And so the Bayh-Dole Act, which was enacted in 1980, was to sort of fix that situation, was written so that the government funds an research. So if the government here gave, the NIH gave money to Stanford for research, that Stanford has the option to own the invention. If the government doesn't decide that it wants it, then Stanford can own the invention, and the company or the university can go about commercializing the invention, do the follow-on research, the testing, all of the rest of the steps to actually get the invention commercialized and out there for the public good. And so it's a really good framework under the Bayh-Dole Act. And so now this case tests sort of the boundaries of how that works, because there's also the right of inventors in the U.S. to assign their inventions to who they want to. In the U.S., patents issue to the name of the inventor, and then they assign their rights perhaps to the company that employed them or to some other party. The issue in this case has to do with that assignment. Essentially, there was a researcher working at Stanford who was doing research under this NIH grant. And so he had agreements in place with Stanford, of course, for the work that he was doing. He also was working part of the time using laboratory facilities owned by a private company. And he had agreements, confidentiality agreements, and others in place with that laboratory company. And so there were all these various agreements around who owns the rights in the inventions that this researcher comes up with. And so that's where the battle is now, is the district court and the federal circuit found that the research company, the party, which is now Roche, owns some interest in what the researcher invented and therefore can't infringe any patents that Stanford has covering his work. And so there's a dispute among the parties, and certainly that's important to the parties, but this case is important to the larger IP community because it could really affect the types of inventions that universities and other nonprofits are willing to invest in using government money. And as I said, there are a lot of inventions over the years like this one, important drug developments, important diagnostic testing. Even Google is an example of an innovation that began at its heart with some government-funded research and then was commercialized by other parties under the Bayh-Dole Act. So it could have very important ramifications for a big part of our economy, particularly the research and innovation that's conducted by companies and universities under grants from the federal government.
Justin, while these three patent cases that you and Erica have just spoke about, while they're significant, are there other cases to watch in 2011?
Yeah, there are two issues that we're kind of keeping an eye on that the Supreme Court may address in the coming year. The first is whether the court will again look to address the scope of patentable subject matter under Section 101, that is, what type of inventions are eligible for patent protection at the first instance. With their decision in Bilski v. Kappos last year, the court somewhat reset the law in this area, pointing to their previous precedents. But it also left open further development. There are numerous cases percolating up in the PTO, district courts, and at the federal circuit in the wake of all the various decisions and attention on Section 101. So we could see the Supreme Court again take up another case in a different technology area, such as software, biotech, or even look to business methods again to see if it wants to further define the law in this area. And then another issue is whether the Supreme Court will take up cases dealing with Section 112 of the Patent Act, which defines many of the formal aspects of the patent, such as its written description or how the claims have to be formed in a patent, which really give the patent its power. In particular, we have a petition in Aplericor v. Enzo Biochem, which is challenging the Federal Circuit standard for finding if a claim is definite enough. That is, how well-defined does a claim have to be in laying out what it covers in order to be eligible for patent protection, in order to get through the PTO. The current standard is that a claim must not be insolubly ambiguous. It must just be capable of being construed in some way, which is a fairly loose standard. The petitioners are arguing that there has to be a higher standard and there has to be less ambiguity in claims in order for them to be allowed. The Supreme Court has not yet accepted the case, but has asked the Solicitor General to weigh in, indicating that they have at least some interest in the issue and may end up taking the case within the next few months, depending on where the Solicitor General will come down on behalf of the government.
Erica, let's talk about trends here for a moment. It appears that over the, let's say, the last decade, the Supreme Court has taken a lot more interest in patent cases. They've heard several substantial cases each term, and it looks like 2011 is going to pretty much fall in line with this trend of increased IP activity. What's going on? What are your thoughts on the evolving landscape, and how is this affecting the industry overall?
It's very interesting. We've had a few decades since the early 80s with only a handful of patent cases being heard by the Supreme Court. In the very early 1980s, the judiciary formed the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It's a special appellate court with limited jurisdiction, primarily created to decide appeals in patent cases. And so for a long time after that court was created, the Supreme Court really left patent cases alone and allowed the Federal Circuit to do its job to provide consistency across patent law, which is a federal law, for all of the country. But then more recently, the court has started taking almost every term at least one patent case. And as you said, lately, this year, they have three. And so they certainly seem to be more interested in patent cases. And I think that's for a couple of different reasons. One is just I think that the patent system overall has become more prominent in our economy as we've shifted from a manufacturing economy into more of an information economy. And there are new industries like biotechnology. There's a lot more reliance and use of patents to fund development and research. And so even President Obama talks about innovation being a key driver in our economic recovery. And so innovation, inventions, and patents have become more prominent, I think, nationally. And so when a subject like patent law becomes more important nationally, it would naturally catch the court's attention. There's also some debate over whether the court is pro-patent or anti-patent, and if you look at sort of the trends of their decisions, whether they are strengthening the patents that have issued or if they are making it easier to challenge them, and court watchers sort of wait to see if the court is headed in a more pro-patent or anti-patent direction. But really, I think the court has shown that it's willing to listen to patent cases, particularly when many big players get involved and start filing amicus, friend of the court briefs to highlight these cases to the court and to call them to their attention. Then I think they've shown a willingness to consider some of these issues, even disagreeing with the Federal Circuit on occasion, which is, you know, something that we saw a lot of during the last decade.
Our guests have been Erica Arner, partner, and Justin Lowry, associate from Finnegan, one of the largest IP law firms in the world. To stay current on patent cases at the Supreme Court, to listen to other podcasts, and to receive additional information on the firm, please visit www.finnegan.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Finnegan.